So welcome everybody to the last session of Hunting Magic Eels. So if you have not gotten your magic eel yet, this is your final chance. And as we start this evening, I want to invite us into, we'll do another charismatic enchantment practice. But I want to do a really specific kind of testimony that I want to invite from each of you. So I want to invite a specific testimony to help us notice how productive it is to be made really uncomfortable. So when we are uncomfortable, we have to grow and develop and give more of ourselves than we had previously been giving. So I'm going to invite each of us to, in just one or two sentences, tell us something about this study of hunting magic eels that has made you uncomfortable. Something about this study that has made you uncomfortable. And this will be sort of liturgical too, because there's going to be a response. Everybody, when you hear somebody say what made them uncomfortable, your job is to say, thank God for that. Okay, can you do that? Thank God for that. Because this is not just testimony to discomfort, right? This is testimony to the way that God gives us that discomfort to open us up and prompt us to grow. So again, just one, maybe two sentences about something about this study that has made you uncomfortable. And I will say this, this whole charismatic approach, you're allowed to repeat things too if somebody else takes yours. This whole charismatic approach to, man, if somebody thinks that that's where God showed up in their life, then that's where God showed up in their life. That makes me really uncomfortable.
Thank God for that.
That was right, yeah.
I found it uncomfortable to think of so many different things as possibly being in the same train of thought as God.
Thank God for that.
I have found it uncomfortable that so many people, and I'm thinking of my brother-in-law, who is an evangelical pastor, can have experiences in which he finds God that I wouldn't notice or think of and maybe wouldn't believe.
Thank God for that.
Bruce would like to go.
I was uncomfortable reading about St. Francis kissing lepers.
Yeah. Yes.
Thank God for that.
So was St. Francis.
Well, then the guy disappeared.
Yeah. Oh, that was beautiful. I like that. I have to be honest. I think I was so amazed. I was never in fear. This was an enlightening segment. I just take what all of you say as the truth and the sharing that we do. I didn't find anything that made me really uneasy. It made me question, but I'd have to look back at the episodes to see why I was questioning. There was one thing in particular, but it wasn't uncomfortable. It's, you know, I think, well, that's all for now.
Thank God for that.
I was a little uncomfortable with the thought of enchantment being very similar to things that we've talked about for a long time about being called and about what additional meaning is added when you say, I'm enchanted with that.
Thank God for that.
Well, I'm an impatient person. And when I read that part in there where he's talking about you're in the grocery store and you're in line waiting for, hurry up, you know, get through the line. And you should be, you know, thinking what good is going on? You know, shouldn't be impatient. And anyway, finding ways to look for the good that's going on around you instead of getting impatient. So I felt guilty that I'm not always doing that.
Thank God for that.
We thank God for all of that holy discomfort that has been brought into our lives through this study. So I want to, since this is our last study, I want to remember where we have been over the past, this is our fifth week. So we talked about enchanted and disenchanted faith. So we talked about enchanted faith that has that kind of magical feel. And as we sort of culturally sort of grew past that sense of magic and the supernatural, our faith has kind of disenchanted. We're not looking for where God is anymore. And again, that happened through modern patterns of thought, which are both, you know, scientific skepticism and that really Protestant sort of resistance to superstition. And those patterns of thought have led us to quit looking for experiences of the God that we say we believe in. So where we need to look for those experiences is outside of ourselves. We're talking about eccentric experiences that lead us to find purpose and meaning, not within ourselves, but beyond ourselves. And that's sort of one of the hallmarks of these authentic experiences of God. And we talked last week about the way that enchantment is not neutral. It's not just either, oh, you're enchanted or you're not enchanted, but the enchantments that we're looking for in the world, they have content that ideally points our attention toward God. So the question for tonight is, how do we tell which enchantments point us toward God as opposed to pointing us toward something else? How do we discern? To discern is to tell the difference, between what points us toward God and what points us away from God or leads us not to look with clear eyes at God. So which chapter was this? Bad with numbers. Chapter 11, Bev says chapter 2. Chapter 11 begins with a story from early in Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and an experience that he had as he was making a name for himself in the civil rights movement. He was a relatively new pastor in the city of Montgomery, and they were boycotting the buses, and he was getting blowback about that. And so I'll just read a bit here. Not everyone was thrilled. Threats were made, warnings given. Then came the midnight phone call on January 27th, 1956. If you aren't out of this town in 3 days, we're going to blow up your house and blow your brains out. The threat pushed Martin to the breaking point. Something in the voice told him that his life was now on the line. and not just his life, but the lives of his wife and their new baby daughter sleeping down the hall. Wide awake now and unable to go back to bed, Martin made himself some coffee. Fear filled him as he sat down at the table in the dark kitchen. The despair was overwhelming. He began to pray, "Lord, I am here taking a stand for what I believe is right, but now I am afraid. The people are looking to me for leadership, and if I stand before them without strength and courage, they too will falter. I am at the end of my powers. I have nothing left. I have come to the point where I can't face it alone." In the darkness of that small kitchen, God spoke to Martin. A voice said to him, "Martin Luther, stand up for truth. Stand up for justice. Stand up for righteousness. God will be at your side forever." Hearing those words, the fears evaporated. Resolution, conviction, and courage returned. Sitting alone in the middle of the night, Martin Luther King Jr. responded to God's calling, committing himself to the path of justice and civil rights. It was the decisive moment of his life, the religious experience when Martin Luther King Jr., aspiring college professor, became Martin Luther King Jr., hero and martyr of the American Civil Rights Movement. Now, what's moving about that story for me is the need that Martin, Dr. King, please, the need that Dr. King felt there in that kitchen, the need to depend on God. You know, he's this eloquent, scholarly pastor, and he was not planning on the work that he was being called to. And yet, God was about to lead him and use him every step along that way. So when we say God spoke to Martin, now when it's Dr. King, we understand, you know, that's someone God would spend time speaking to. But when we say God spoke to so-and-so, and we say God spoke to me, how do we know that? How do we tell the difference between what is God's voice and what is our voice? So we've talked last week especially about what God's voice is not. That's kind of what we were talking about last week. God's voice is not a voice that just tells us what we already think, including about our own, you know, politics and sense of our place in the world. And God's voice is not something that we can curate so that it only includes what is beautiful and easy and makes us feel good. And it's not God's voice if it is excusing, you know, excusing our selfishness or leading us to ignore difficulties as we deal with the world around us. None of those are what God's voice sounds like. But the Bible is also clear, not just about those things, but the Bible is also clear about what it sounds like when it is God's voice. So when it is God's voice, it sounds like Moses listening to the burning bush, calling him to give his life away for others. Or it sounds like the vision that Peter had of ritually unclean animals that were not about the animals at all. It was about a call to go tear down the walls that separate ethnic groups from each other. Or it's about the prophet Jonah hearing a call to go and preach repentance, which means to preach grace to his nation's sworn enemies. Or Saint Francis, facing his disgust and dread of lepers by going to live among them and serve them. So this vision of the leper on the road, that was one thing. That's what God's voice said, or that was God's voice speaking to him. But what was God saying? God was saying, this is where your life is now, right? So God's enchantment, this is Beck now, God's enchantment will take you to places where you have to deal with your gag reflex. So God's enchantment will take you not only into beauty and comfort and joy, but also into ugliness and difficulty. And that's actually how you can tell that you're listening to God's voice and not some other voice. The fancy word for that is cruciform. Cruciform means shaped like a cross, which is to say that what God calls us to is a life that is modeled after Jesus' self-giving love. So that's when we talked about Celtic enchantments last week. Celtic enchantments celebrate not only the sun, but also the rain. And we can sort of, you know, especially those of us who grew up in farm country, right? We understand part of why that is, right? You can grow crops with sun and rain, but you can't grow crops with either sun or rain. You need them both, right? And you can grow a spiritual life with joy and sorrow, but you can't grow a spiritual life with only joy or sorrow. So Jesus reminds us when we think about the sun and the rain. God makes the sun and the rain fall upon the just and the unjust. That's cruciform love. That is not only for our friends, but for our enemies. So St. Martin of Montgomery and Atlanta, he had this eccentric experience of grace. And that eccentric experience of grace carried him not only through amazing feats of strength of spirit, but also to his martyrdom, to his death eventually. And so that grace is always both things. So enchantment takes work. And part of the reason that God's enchantment takes work is because we naturally gravitate toward one side or the other of those experiences. We naturally gravitate, many of us, to what is easy and joyful and happy and beautiful. Some of us, to be honest, gravitate toward the things that are difficult and painful and have a harder time seeing the joy and the beauty. We need both of those experiences. And in order to have those experiences, that's why we've been working at this. So again, this book began with Richard Beck having traveled a long way down the road, nurturing his skepticism and his doubt. He wanted a really good, robust faith. And so he tested it against all of these different reasons not to believe, which meant he was giving his attention to all the reasons not to believe, all the ways not to have an experience of God in the world. And so that's what he found. He found reasons to doubt. He found ways to dry up his faith. And finally, he realized that he had been selecting for those in what he was looking for. And so he said, well, if I directed my attention here, I could direct my attention somewhere else. He directed his attention to those prayer ropes and those icons and this embodied worship, and started to recognize that God speaks through many of those practices. So he framed some of this narrative for us in terms of The Brothers Karamazov by Dostoevsky. The character arc that goes on in there, as Alyosha is trying to sort of navigate his own faith life in the world. And Beck had started this book more than once and got as far as there are no reasons for everything. Everything's meaningless. God doesn't exist. And he said, well, that sounds about like where my faith is right now, and closed the book and moved on. And then he read finally on to the end of the book. Near the end of the book, there's a conversation with a wise old monk, Zosima. And he's giving his final sermon before he dies. And he says, I'll read just this little paragraph. He says, love all of God's creation, both the whole of it and every grain of sand. Love every leaf, every ray of God's light, love animals, love plants, love each thing. If you love each thing, you will perceive the mystery of God in things. Once you have perceived it, you will begin tirelessly to perceive more and more of it every day. And you will come at last to love the world with an entire universal love. So love is the enchantment of creation. Love is what turns life into a fairy tale. Remember, we talked about fairy tales that open our eyes to see more than what we can just tangibly see. Love changes our perception. So it's apocalyptic, it's revelatory. It shows us what had otherwise been veiled in the world around us. And love is cruciform, that word again. God's enchantment calls us to love the hard and the difficult and the ugly. And so, dear reader, this is my final encouragement. Love like the sunshine and the rain. Ask forgiveness of the birds. Be a drop more gracious, tender, and kind. Go gently in this mean world. Offer up prayers of thanks, help, and wow. Recover your sacramental wonder. Count your blessings. Look to the horizon in the valley of dry bones. Remember that you are a child of God. Rush to kiss the lepers. Listen to the voice in the night calling you to the cross. Turn your attention to the God dancing right in front of you. God is everywhere present, breathing on this world and turning it to fire. Where you stand is the gateway to heaven. The world is shining like transfiguration, even the eels. It only takes a little willingness to see. So one more time, I invite you to chew and swallow. So I'll give us one brief minute of silence. Notice what you have heard that has interested you, challenged you, inspired you. Notice any questions that have come up for you in this minute. So what has come up for you? What have you noticed that has intrigued you, that has made you want to dig deeper? What questions are you carrying with you?
If we were to say that we could learn from denominations or Christians who are much more animated in their faith, is that a, you understand where I'm going with that, I think, then how do we tell just ritual from connection? And I know we've been talking about that the whole time, but I don't have an answer yet. Because some people find ritual, find great connection, for example, in the ritual of communion. And while I respect it and honor it and understand what it's there for, I don't just get this feeling that I'm a foot closer to heaven when I've got the cup and bread in my hand.
So how do we how do we discern the difference between ritual, and really this could be ritual either in that structured liturgical sense or that big expressive sense, which that big expressive sense has to be cultivated ritually as well. How do we differentiate between that as a form of worship and the connection with God that we are talking about here? And talk specifically about that emotive worship, because that's the that's farther from home for most of us.
I will add that, and this is not to knock Catholics, it's a question about how Catholics experience all this. A lot of them, I think, at least traditional Catholics, find that magic eel there in the half hour of the Mass, and then don't think they have to give it another thought for the rest of the week. I think of the scene in Godfather, I think it's one, but it might be two, where the killings are all done while Michael is at church, baptizing his grandson or his son or something. And the magic is there in church. What happens outside church seems to have nothing to do with it.
So, there's an experience within worship, or really an experience in whatever these places are that we are experiencing God. And then there's the rest of the world and the rest of our lives, and sort of how do you know that the one is shaping the other? How do you know that the experience of God is shaping the way you live? Or are we dealing with two different questions here?
That could be a question. I'm not even quite sure what question I'm asking, except I'll repeat that I don't know how to tell the difference. I don't have the feeling that if I'm inside our building, that things are much different, except that we've gotten together to talk and celebrate. And if I happen to be having a bad day and I don't pay a doggone bit of attention to the sermon, that's okay. It'll work out later in the afternoon.
Yeah, so what difference does it make, the things that we do, the experiences that we have? What difference does it make later in the afternoon? Bruce?
I think it's all about choices. You choose what is comfortable for you, what is happy for you. I choose joy. I choose positives, okay? And I choose to try to avoid negatives. And I think in choosing that way, it's like a meditation. You're clearing your mind of all the crud, and you're inviting in all of the goodness. And in doing so, you perhaps are doing God's will.
Just show of hands, how many of you got an email from Bruce with a 4-minute video? Most of you. Okay, I didn't know whether I was the only one who got it.
I sent it to everybody. It was worth it.
I didn't notice. My feeling related to what you're saying, Bruce, about choosing was that all sounded very Buddhist to me, which is not to say anti-Christian. I don't think they're incompatible at all. But the choices that were being made in there sounded like the mindset of somebody in Buddhism, and maybe there are 10 other Eastern religions that would qualify too, but that's the only one I know anything about. That's my answer to your question just now, making those choices, what to think about, what to notice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think part of what Beck is inviting us to do is to be choiceful about where we put our minds and our attention. So, and I think he doesn't say anything about Buddhism in here. I can't remember what he has said about Buddhism in general. He does not seem to be a Christian exclusivist. So, but I don't know what he has specifically written about Buddhism, but I think he would recognize that same connection, that there is a matter of cultivation here. And cultivation, incidentally, is probably a better translation of the word in the Buddhist scriptures that often gets translated meditation. And that means that cultivation happens in more than just sitting quietly in a room.
Buddhism is said to be a way of life or a way of thinking. And that, again, somehow might be the answer to both Bruce's question and your question, Nathan. How do we take the experience of a few minutes, whether it's looking at a beautiful forest or listening to a beautiful sermon, how do we take that into the rest of the week? That's my answer, although I'm not quite sure what my answer means.
Other things that have come up for folks as we've been going through this material these weeks.
Perry and I watched a documentary or a series, I'm not sure which, on CNN this morning called United Shades of America. And it was about mostly spoken by minorities, a lot of Black voices. And one of the things that has stuck with me throughout the day is a young woman who was Black who said, "We watch the war going on in Afghanistan as if it's another world and it's not something we ever experience. But I wake up every morning feeling like I live there because when my kids walk out the door, I don't know if they're going to be attacked by a terrorist that we call police and not come home that day. And having three grandkids that are Black makes me worry about them. And especially, you know, Chris is turning 14 and I have to think he is the quietest, most gentle-spirited person I know. But what happens when he goes to high school next year? Or a couple years from now when he's in a car with somebody, how do I keep him safe from that? And what would happen to my religious belief if he isn't kept safe? Like, I grew up with all these thoughts going on, and right now Christianity is being divided by Black Lives Matter. And a look at how police are enforcing laws and not enforcing laws, that they're acting not to keep peace. But a lot of people are getting shot in the back. And I'm just questioning so much right now. And looking at this book and listening to the discussion, I keep going back to, what do I contemplate? Like, how do I get up every morning and find joy and hope and love? And then have all this going on around me.
Deb, partly brought to mind by what you just said, and I didn't see W. Kamau Bell's thing last night. I watched, I actually caught up on Resident Alien, but that's another whole story. And if you haven't seen that, go binge watch it. It's
definitely
it's one of the better shows that have been on in recent years. Anyway, yeah. I think of the emphasis from Black Lives Matter, or if not from the group, then from what they're bringing up about how they have to constantly live the realities that you were just talking about. And I don't.
Right.
I can walk out of the house in the morning and not wonder whether somebody's going to shoot me because I'm white. They don't have that luxury. Maybe that's where this insinuates itself on our lives.
So I'm hearing something in that about that there is something eccentric there, something that because it's inviting you to be attentive to a voice that is outside of your experience.
Yes.
And John and Deb, you both described the way that that living as a Black person in the United States is not in your experience. And so the ways that changes, for their experience, it changes how the world looks from that perspective. But hearing that voice is also pulling you out of your perspective.
It's pulling me out of my comfort zone. Knowing that Martin Luther King felt the way he felt the night he had that enchanted experience, that he was 25, and I was guessing he was a whole lot older. I think he aged during the years he was front and center, like presidents do. We watch them age in 4 to 8 years, and they look 20, 30 years older when they leave the office. I think Martin Luther King must have experienced that same thing. I had no idea he was that young.
You take, again, taking your example a bit further and trying to play with it. What's your word, chew and swallow, Nathan?
Chew and swallow.
Outside many parts of the first world where we live, people do have to wonder every day whether they're going to get their daily bread or whether some revolutionary is going to come by and blow something up. And they have to be attentive to the role that God, however they see him, might play.
So this book has me contemplating a lot of different things than I was before we started discussion and I started reading it. And it's the same thing that when you come back from El Salvador, we hear from one person after another of how incredibly thoughtful, how grateful, how loving the people in El Salvador are. And yet, by any one of our standards of living, they're poor and unlucky. But they don't see themselves as that way. And we don't see them as that way because we've gotten to know them. But I know everybody that comes back talks about selling their houses and selling all their belongings and trying to live a simpler lifestyle.
Yeah, there's something about that experience. I mean, that's something that travel does to us, and particularly that kind of mission partnership travel. And it's not like the people in El Salvador don't know that they're poor.
Right.
Right. But they do know things that we tend to forget because we're not poor enough.
Yeah.
So there's something, what I hear you describing there is that it's not just, oh man, the world and all the everything. I mean, that's part of it, right? But there's also, wow, there's this wonder that I've been there and I've seen something that I didn't expect to see. Mm-hmm. And that's the, you know, Beck told us narrated for us the story of Moses out, you know, tending the sheep and doing the whatever, and there's, oh, this bush is on fire, right? And he had to say, hang on a second, I have to turn and look at that, right? I've read this story in Hebrew, it's very specific, like he has to stop and turn aside, and he says this to himself you know, I have to turn and see this thing because it's weird and wonderful. So there's a wonderful to this as well. Yeah. Bev.
I think at the end of Beck's book, that end of chapter 11 and into the epilogue, it was wow that hit me the biggest. And that's exactly, John, as you say, Deb, with your experience. John, one question I had for you was when those people that we are uncomfortable with, whatever that we're not used to in the first world that we live in, do those people even realize where they are? Other than now that the awareness, I mean, in the last 15, 20 years, there's such an awareness. This last year and a half have been wonderfully insightful for those of us in the first world to learn what a mother has to tell her son before he goes out to be safe, because he isn't the color of our police departments and whatever. For safety's sake. And so those are the kind of things, and you know, Deb brought it up and brought that tie together mm-hmm. with El Salvador. And there are so many, many ports we've been in that you think it's a port, oh, it's beautiful, but you go beyond that fence one block and they are tent city. And that is so enlightening to see. Or being in Chiapas, Mexico, the southernmost state is where my sister is. And that is enlightening. And I really think, I don't know how to put this. I don't think it scares me though. Just, you know, that's the part when you said, what makes you uncomfortable? When I think about comfortable, it's a fear. Well, like St. Francis supposedly had, and that's when he went up and made amends with himself. You know, the leper didn't know that St. Francis didn't like him, but that was his enlightenment. And, you know, that was his fear. So I don't know. I think we are exposed to so much. Nothing really shocks us anymore, does it? Other than mass shootings and ugliness like that. So anyway, but that was good to hear, John and Deb, the end of what you were saying.
I sent some of you something from the book Snowball by Warren Buffett. And it's something that hit me between the eyes is, he says, I won the ovarian lottery.
I've heard that.
We were born to the right parents, okay, at the right time. And he especially, he had the roof over his head, everything he needed. He had all the opportunities, the education, just everything that was taken for granted. And we are so blessed to have whiteness and parents that are caring and loving and children who turn out great. And it's just what a contrast with billions of people who did not win the ovarian lottery.
Very true.
No roof over their head, mud floors, nothing right. to eat, and bad water. Just, it's just, what a contrast.
And in being Christian, we're not luckier. Well, I mean, I guess we're lucky to have won that lottery, but we're not more blessed and we're not better than the people that didn't win that lottery. And that's the part you have to keep contemplating and keep in front of you. We're not better.
We are the same, flesh and blood.
Right.
And that is a very.
And that's why I keep doing these classes. I keep trying to get it through my thick skull that I'm not better and I don't deserve more. But I've got to reach out and keep showing that love to as many other humans as I can.
Part of what makes me uncomfortable about those charismatic enchantments and the, you know, sort of the count your blessings approach is sort of the way that it demands that response that I invited you to give when we talked about our testimonies this evening. You know, thank God for that. And there's a one of the really strong arguments against all this enchantment stuff is the idea that if something good happened and I say, oh, you know, God bless me with such and such, and somehow that the argument goes that that is implying that God did not choose to bless, you know, our neighbors in San Ysidro with something that good, with something that they needed probably more than I did, right? And so there's this justice argument against that blessing language. Or the flip side of that really this is the other side of again the important skepticism that makes especially the charismatic enchantments hard for me, the praying that that God will heal somebody from a terrible disease, and God is really unlikely to heal them of that terrible disease, right? Statistically, we know that to be the case. And so how do you pray for healing that is mathematically really unlikely to come? And, and maybe this is just a thing that people who go through pastoral care training have to get hit with, but that sort of, is God up there somewhere choosing, who gets the good things and who doesn't get the good things, and who gets the bad things and who doesn't get the bad things? And that's not what this sense of enchantment is trying to do, but that's the skeptical voice in my head. And so so Warren Buffett makes it, not that he was blessed to be born when and where and how he was, but he won the lottery, right? And the ovarian lottery in this instance, right? He's won, multiple lotteries worth otherwise of the dollar lottery. But that this was random, right? And that's what lotteries are. They're random. So this idea that what if Warren Buffett was born when and how he was, and God was behind that in some meaningful way, and I was born when and how I was, and God was behind that in some meaningful way, and when I look at the world around me and the ways that I am, I'm going to say lucky because I'm stuck to this random lottery language, right? I'm so stinking blessed. Why was I blessed? What's that for? What does that call me into, right? That's the divine, the God's enchantment language, that it calls you into something, right? So it wasn't just, a voice saying to Martin at midnight in 1956, hey, you're fine, it's good, don't worry about it, right? It's no, I've got a job for you, right? And looking back those years on, we can say, yeah, God had a job for him 65 years ago. But the dynamic of that voice, you know, that experience of God, it's an experience of the living God, then that means that it also draws us not just out of ourselves and our experience, but it draws us into some kind of calling.
Just as an aside, today's news had Bill and Linda Gates separating.
I was looking something up this evening and I saw that in the news and I was surprised.
Yeah. Buffett and Gates have done wonders with their wealth as far as trying to make the world better and give it away.
So there is some calling built into that, right? And it's entirely possible to get super stinking rich and not do any good with it.
Right.
And it's possible to do a lot of good with something and still could have been more good to have done.
There's always room, I think, for us to learn. And I think thank yous, not always, I don't always consider thing a blessing. My response is always, oh, thank you, Lord, for that. And I don't, maybe I'm just, scaring me. Maybe I don't see the questions.
I like Beck's very final paragraph. It kind of, summarize things in a very simple but powerful way. Love like the sunshine and the rain. You know, now that gives you pause. You know, it's everywhere. And love, add to that, add to the world's sunshine and rain. And I also like go gently in this mean world. That really struck me. You know, there's all kinds of challenges, but just go gently, walk gently. I thought that was meaningful. And be a drop, more gracious, tender, and kind. That's all he's asking. Just be a drop, you know, just get, just like that. Just get, you know, get yourself out there. Recover your sacramental wonder. And I thought this book was great, you know, especially on that score, you know, looking at experiences of people through the centuries and keep that going. Look to the horizon in the valley of the dry bones. I like that. These images are great. He is really great.
Picturesque, isn't he?
Yeah.
I mean, it's easy, the picture that he's presenting.
And rush to kiss the lepers, not just, you know, make sure you have that experience, but rush out there. Oh, gee.
That's right.
I always think about that when I pass by someone that's at the corner, you know, with a bucket asking for cash. And that really just kind of shakes me up every time. What is the situation? I usually put stuff in if it's a hoax, then it'll work out some way. If it's not, hey, maybe that's lunch.
I was just going to say, someone suggested, we have a friend that we met on a cruise, and he is doing good by helping those that he meets along his way. He's now got a foundation and he is using donations to help those people on the corners and the people standing outside of Walmart with a basket that they're not allowed in because they stole food. I mean, there are different things there, but, I forgot what I was gonna say about it though, Marilyn, it was direct with what you had. And he, you just never know where you're going to meet that. And when I drive to Beaverdale to go and get my granddaughters and bring them back here, there's one at 42nd and the off ramp of 235. There's one at the corner by US Cellular and Sprint on 42nd and University. And there's also another at the bottom of 22nd Street when you get off to turn left to go towards Ashworth. And they switch places. And I have also given, and Bruce is skeptical of that. And I wonder, does anyone have the answer? John, maybe you know. Is that a hoax? Are those men hoax? But I wave to him now every time and they're waving back. And I feel that, you know, he doesn't remember me from up, I'm sure. But it's just a friendly wave and a smile. I'm, you know, I don't know much about. So, John, do you have an answer? Do you know?
The answer I have in my mind when I drive past those people, which I do, okay, is that I can try to do my part by giving other ways, notably through the church, and try to help in possibly more constructive ways. I don't think there's anything more hoaxy than somebody says he can probably make more money holding out a bucket than he can going to a minimum wage job, but I don't know.
That is their job.
That's my own rationalization.
Right, but I didn't know if that ever came through anything you've experienced with law, as far as, is it a ring?
Is it a what, a ring?
A ring, you know, like a...
like an organized group?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, led by someone who's dropping them off or putting them on bikes and sending them.
Nathan, I've wondered, but I have no idea. I've wondered, but I have no idea. I'm sure they know each other.
So when Emma was a little girl, like 3 or 4, there was a guy that stood by the off ramp on Merle Hay Road and off of I-80. And we were always on the wrong edge of the street. So she was really worried about this guy. And we live about 6 blocks from that corner, half a mile at the very most. We got home and she started getting bread out and bologna, and she was going to make sandwiches. And then she got a box and started, and I'm just watching her amazed. I mean, she was fast. She was making 8 bologna sandwiches and wanted them in a box. And we had cupcakes, and by golly, cupcakes had to go in there. And she wanted to go back and give them to this guy. And so I'm thinking, he probably doesn't want bologna sandwiches and cupcakes, but I want my kids to always be looking out for others. So we got in the car, we drove back, made sure we were on the right side of the street. That man was the kindest, nicest, most grateful man I have ever met. And Emma still thinks about that, and we still try to give whenever we can. I too, like you guys said, try to give through organized missions and hope that it gets to them in some way. But bologna sandwiches and cupcakes is our motto here.
That's what I was going to finish that story with, is that he made lunch for 40 people and handed it out. And it was simple food. It was sandwiches and a bag of chips and a bottle of water. Yeah, bottle of water even. And just keep it in. He just keeps it in his van. And I thought, okay, you know, that's not cool. A bad thought. Nathan?
No,
you...
that's
not.
Yeah.
A little over a year ago, a year and a few months, we attended a meeting, excuse me, and Joe and Jackie Stevens were the invited guests. They're the founders of JAPA. And they told us a lot about their organization. One of the things they mentioned was when they see panhandlers, they hand out a
blessing bag.
Blessing bag. It's a cloth bag with
water, granola bar,
crackers,
a few other things.
Various things like that in it. So Mary has made quite a few of those. We always keep one in the car, and we find a panhandler on a street corner and roll down the window and grab the bag and hand it to him. They're always
very appreciative.
Yeah, very, very appreciative to get it.
One of the things I've heard, Russ, is that socks are more needed than almost anything. So maybe if any of us decide to make blessing bags like you're doing, we could put a pair of socks in there. Granola bar, bottle of water, socks, some Kleenex.
Yeah, I get different things in it.
Yeah.
Nathan, I am going to ask this question only because you have more training in comparative religions than we do, I think. Do the traditions of the Islamic religion, faith, and Judaism have a bigger dose of what we've been talking about, paying attention?
That's an interesting question. Each of these, as if religions are, each of them in their own little box and they never interact with each other. Each of them are sort of they have different practices of attention. And so Judaism and Islam both are much more sort of concerned with the particulars of how you live. So Christianity has this very sort of anti-law posture relative to the foundational texts of all of Scripture. It puts us in a really weird position, but we want to put the Ten Commandments on a pedestal outside a courthouse, but we don't necessarily want to live nine of them. And so there's a complicated posture that we have to telling us how to live, right? We want to say, love God, love your neighbor, nothing else matters. As if nothing else matters. And we do a lot of theology. We do a lot of thinking. Both Judaism and Islam have very sort of experiential traditions and practices as well. But all the time we spend thinking about theology, right? Getting all of our doctrine right. Judaism is really sort of what Judaism does in place of theology. They do theology, they have teachings about God, but what they really have is the law. They have reflections on how did God tell us to live, 613 commandments that the first century rabbis sorted out and said, okay, these are all the commandments, and they include things like, don't harvest your fields all the way up to the edges because the outside of your field is for the sojourner and the orphan and the widow. So people who don't have income should be able to walk up to your farm field and take your grain. That's in Deuteronomy. And Leviticus, I think both. Islam, in place of theology, has jurisprudence. So it sounds a lot more like, again, how do we behave relative to each other? Now, there are also traditions about, 99 names of God. And so ways of understanding and picturing who God is. And what really matters is how you live. What really matters is, and really specifically, how you interact with other people. And so these are different sort of approaches and angles into this. I will say, and I struggle with this and never do it the way I intend to, but what do you do with panhandlers? And I'm in the really I'm in the enviable position of spending my work day inside an institution that people come to ask for things. So I don't just have to go past an intersection. And so I'm just going to read a little bit. This is from Luke chapter 6 for y'all. Jesus has just said the Beatitudes. You remember those, right? Like, happy are the poor, and happy are you who hunger now, and weep now, and blah, 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 all that stuff, right? And then he goes on, and he says, this is Jesus talking, but I say to you who are willing to hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, pray for those who mistreat you. I'm getting to it. If someone slaps you on the cheek, offer the other one as well. If someone takes your coat, don't withhold your shirt either. You were with him all the way up until now. But here's what he says next. Give to everyone who asks, and don't demand your things back from those who take them. And then wraps that up with treat people in the same way that you want them to treat you. But that little commandment, it's a commandment, right? Jesus is giving instructions here. Give to everyone who asks. And I totally don't, right? If I'm trying to earn my way into heaven with this, I'm not getting there. That's not what these instructions are about. But give to everyone who asks, because it's so dang short and so easy to follow, or at least easy to know whether or not I'm following it. There's a discernment practice right there. You know, and this isn't wrapped up in the sort of, you know, wonderful mystical language of Matthew 25, where, you know, as you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. And like, that's lovely. And it's there, Jesus said that too. But it's just an instruction, right? He just gives us this instruction. Give to everyone who asks. And I don't. I don't manage to. I don't figure out how to. Shane Claiborne, who is a leader of a Christian community in Philadelphia, North Philly, who they have chosen to plant their community among the poor. And he says, you want to get asked for stuff, you plant a community among the poor. And he says, we don't always give people money, but we give them something, whether it's time or, you know, a phone number to call looking for a job or whatever it is, we find some way to give to that person. And that's hard work. And this is hard work, right? And so I think there is, I was wondering, you know, and maybe I haven't gotten us all the way back on the rails here, but I was wondering, like, okay, like, we're in this, like, oh man, like there's a person, you know, and, you know, there but for the grace of God go I, except that what am I supposed to do right here in my nice car with the air conditioner running and, you know, my lunch in the back, right? What do I do? And there's Jesus. And like, for me, this is testimony now. For me, that voice in the back of my head saying, give to everyone who asks. I hate that voice, right?
Yeah.
I mean, I need that voice. I love that voice. You know, that voice is the ground of my being, and I hate that voice because he's right.
But these days, but you know what's going to happen. You know, these days, can you
like
trust?
People didn't drink off a spare shekel that somebody threw them on their way through the marketplace.
What?
You could have made the exact same argument
always
in Luke chapter 6 verse 30 and a half. If I just give to so and so, they're just going to, you know, they had wine then.
I forget what writer or philosopher said, life, be in it. But that's kind of what we're talking about here, I think. Yeah. And I have a meeting coming up in Virginia Beach. Their tourism slogan is living the life. And I've never been to Virginia Beach, but anything I know so far, it doesn't sound like the life I want to live. But the phrase is interesting.
Okay. All right.
So,
good.
Yeah. So,
the idea.
Yeah. So,
idea still.
So, I answered it kind of flippantly that this is not the first age in which we could say, oh, yeah, but really give to everybody who asks of you. I don't think Jesus said the stuff he said because it was doable.
Yeah.
I think he said the stuff he said because he's breaking something open in us. And you're absolutely right. Like, how do you possibly give to seriously everyone? And it is interesting, and I mean that with a raised eyebrow. It's really interesting how fast we try to not take Jesus literally about that one.
It does strike me, though, that if I become a hermit and give away everything I have, then I can't give to anybody. Maybe I'm a little better off to have a job and have something to give away. I'm just playing with it.
Yeah.
As always, John.
You could make money standing on the street corner.
There's a few left, yeah.
Yeah,
but I get it, that's, thank you for that,
Viv. I like what you just said.
What's that? You could go live on the street corner.
No, you could make money living on a street corner, and then I thought you were going to follow that up with and give away what you don't need.
That would work too.
That was
if you have right. A good day, that was the buy point. Your buddy at the mission yeah. A sandwich.
Nobody that gives away their extra point. Nobody gives away their extra faster than poor people, let me tell you. Warren wants to get in.
Yes.
I've been thinking about or listening to some wonderful points of view here tonight, and I, at the risk of driving Bruce off, I have one more convenience store story. I had my store for 8.5 years north part of Des Moines, that's now ML King, used to be Harding Road, between Hickman and Euclid. And as you can imagine, I had opportunity for people to approach me on wanting some credit for gasoline primarily to get to work. I had some commercial accounts that I inherited, but these would be just individuals that, you know, I just need $5 in gas to get to work today, and then I'll pay you back. So it was a kind of a unpredictable when these appeals would come to me. Now, the rest of the help didn't have that privilege. Just because I was a store owner, they had to talk to me. And also a related was, do you take their personal checks? So I ended up taking personal checks, and I ended up extending credit for gasoline. I didn't extend credit for your cigarettes or your beer or anything else that was in the store. You can get along without that. And what I want to get across is, you will be shocked at the people who bounced a check on you or who failed to repay you for the gasoline credit. If you think you're a pretty good judge of character, at least this individual wasn't. It always surprised me on whose check bounced or who, you know, 10 bucks this week and then 3 weeks later, 10 bucks, and then 3 weeks later, maybe 15, and they, you know, they had paid me. And then the last time, and I didn't know when the last time was, and then I'd never see them again. So what I'm saying is, I think there's a parallel on, if you think you can judge the person standing at the exit ramp with the sign,
right,
you're going to probably be wrong more than you're right. And it was never a case of the amount that I lost put me out of business. It wasn't anything that severe. And going the other way, I had a lot of loyal customers who came because I would take their personal check. But it always I can think of several. You'd never think they would not follow up on their promise to repay for the gasoline, or they would write you a bad check. At least I was not any good at predicting who I'd have my bad debts with. Enough.
That's a way of life with many. They just use you. Mm-hmm. That's
how they get through. Gotta be a rough way of life.
Absolutely.
No. So, yeah. So let me put this sort of final wrapper on it then. Because I went and quoted this guy who said, give to everybody who asks of you and don't ask for repayment.
Right.
Which is what Warren just narrated for us, right? And you know you're going to get had from time to time and you don't know when. And again, this question of, you know, can you predict it? Should you try to predict it? You know, and this is, you know, this instruction here is coming from a guy who, you know, he failed spectacularly at just choosing 12 honest people, right? And so he's not, you know, if we're looking to Jesus for like good advice on how to live successfully, we have to remember this guy made it to 33 and got killed for it.
But he had insight more than we do.
His dad knew everything. Oh, his dad. Yeah. Come on. but here's this guy. And you know, I'm getting a piece of this. I'm really getting enchantment from that teaching, that specific teaching of give to everyone who asks of you. And it's not from hearing the teaching, right? But it is the teaching is so simple, and then I tried it. And I can vouch for everything Warren said, that there are people who I don't take personal checks because I'm not a convenience store. You know, that you'll get had from time to time. And I'll tell you, I'm doing this with your money, by the way. I gamble with the house money. it's the discretionary fund that y'all fund. Thank you for that. And I get had from time to time. I will tell you that up front and clear. I do get had from time to time, and I would do it again, because there is something in the giving.
Right.
That actually, it's not just that Jesus told me to do it, right? There's something in the giving that lets me know why Jesus told me to do it. And so Jesus isn't giving good advice. Dr. Beck, he doesn't go by Dr. Beck, is not giving us good advice, right? The invitation is not to, you'll be successful this way. The invitation is to try this and see what you notice about where God is in the world. And that's why I keep giving money away, your money. I give my money away too, in other contexts. But part of what that's for, and part of what that does, is that it's an attention practice. It's a way of saying, I'm gonna see where this goes. I'm gonna let this play out. And you know, a lot more people might come to my convenience store because I'll take their personal checks, even though I'm going to lose on some, right? Even though some of the checks are going to bounce, or I'll extend them credit, even though some of the people are going to default.